This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Sarah Dingle. This Friday, a warning to company executives they could face legal action if they ignore the risk of climate change. And Facebook's ban on white nationalism. Will it help stop online racism and hate mongering?
White supremacists use dog whistling and metaphors and subtle messages to engage their supporters, and this recognises that and acknowledges that it's not acceptable.
But first, federal Labor has flagged major changes to the Murray-Darling Basin plan if they win the next federal election, including a return to big water buybacks and stripping some powers from the Commonwealth Authority, which manages the basin plan. Labor says it needs to address serious environmental problems which threaten the viability of Australia's biggest river system. Critics say it would open the door to yet more disagreement and increases the likelihood that states will walk away altogether. I spoke to rural reporter Warwick Long. Warwick, what are the changes that Labor is proposing?
They're wide-ranging, Sarah. There's a number of different issues in this change in this plan from Labor announced today, and they will all affect different areas of the basin differently, and each area will find individual pieces most important. To start with, Labor's committing to introducing a bill to remove the cap on buybacks. So this was put on with the support from Labor, it must be said, through the Parliament. Now Labor wants to remove that so they can buy more water to get what the water they need under the basin plan. It also means they want to change how the definitions of how they're affecting communities when they're buying water from it. There's an extra bit of the basin plan that was added to it called the 450 gigalitres water, which was actually added to the basin plan after its first incarnation. And to get that water, it was thought it could only be done in a way that wouldn't damage communities in the Murray-Darling Basin. Now, Labor wants to remove that restriction, which is raising the ire of many an irrigator group today. Also hidden in there, though, are changes to the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, stripping powers away from them, and also acknowledging the effect of climate change impacts on the Basin Plan, which until now, no major party in the Basin Plan itself hasn't really acknowledged in any meaningful way.
Warwick, there's so much controversy about all aspects of the Basin Plan. So far, what has been the response to Labor's announcement?
It has been swift and it has been with fury, particularly from the other side of politics. Water Minister David Littleproud has called this plan a hoax because a lot of these changes announced by Labor require the state's agreement. And getting the states to make these agreements in the first place has not been easy. In fact, it took years. There was a lot of argy-bargy and difficult negotiations to get where we are now. Now, to say it will all be thrown out and changed, the water minister of the day at the moment, David Littleproud, thinks it simply can't be done. Individual state politicians further upstream too are calling this announcement gutless because it's being made in South Australia and there are a lot of state-based politics in the Basin Plan. Many people wanted these changes being so significant to be made in an area where the communities will be affected by them, which means further upstream in the Murray-Darling Basin. And irrigator groups themselves are saying it's unlikely these changes will happen. Here's a little of Steve Wan, who's from the National Irrigators Council, talking today.
It's really important to point out that the 1,500 gigalitre cap was actually introduced with Labor's support. So it's an about-face from Labor on this. We're opposed to lifting the cap, of course. Now, on the 450 gigalitres, I think there's one fundamental thing which the opposition, if it was to make it into government, would need to remember, and that's that you can't implement any of these 450 gigalitre efficiency measures without state cooperation. So if they can't get the states to agree to that change, then they're at an impasse which will effectively cease further action unless the Commonwealth Government wants to try and go it alone, which I think would be quite difficult.
Steve Wan from the National Irrigators Council and before that, rural reporter Warwick Long. Well, Labor's announcement comes less than 2 months after the findings of the Royal Commission into the Murray-Darling Basin were released. Council assisting the Royal Commission was Richard Beasley, SC. He's welcomed the prospect of big water buybacks, saying there's a strong argument that other measures have been a spectacular waste of time.
The easiest way of getting water and the best way is to enable the Commonwealth to buy it. It's only ever been bought from people that wanted to sell. There's been a whole lot of criticism in certain places about the buyback scheme, but completely, a lot of that ignores the facts. The main facts are that most people that sold water to the Commonwealth did not give up farming or leave country towns. They usually, in a huge proportion of the way, sold a partial licence and stayed in the system, and then, you know, they buy extra water on the market. So I think what Labor's proposed here is a good thing.
The federal government, when it was led by Prime Minister Tony Abbott, capped water buybacks.
Yep.
What Labor is saying now is that that cap will be lifted and we can have big amounts of water bought back and put back into the river system. You're saying that's a good idea. Does that mean we've wasted the intervening years and however many millions or perhaps billions of dollars, because those measures, unlike water buybacks, have not delivered the water to the river system?
The way this should have been done is that water should have been... Look, putting in an efficiency system, a drip irrigation instead of a spray system, for example, or lining the way water is delivered to people's places rather than having it seeping into dirt, or doing other things that stave evaporation are generally good ideas, but they're not a great idea in terms of massive amounts of Commonwealth taxpayers' money going to upgrade systems and not getting a precise and amount of water that you know with confidence is going back to the environment. The much better way was voluntary sales. No one's proposing stealing anyone's licence. No one's proposing a compulsory acquisition. This is just enables the Commonwealth government to buy water back from people who want to sell it.
And everything we've done since capping water buybacks has been ineffective?
I think there's massive problems with it, and that's borne out by the Royal Commission report. In relation to efficiency measures, all of the huge amounts of Commonwealth money that have gone to efficiency measures may no doubt have made delivery of water to plants on farmers or big irrigators' crops more efficient. But in terms of delivering water back to the environment, it's very dubious as to whether it's been successful there, which is the whole point of the thing. With Menindee, that's another supply measure. We've found there where there's been like a dress rehearsal of trying to save water evaporating from Menindee, which sounds like a really good idea, but what we've found is that if you empty those lakes more quickly than you should to save evaporation, and then it doesn't rain, you get millions of fish dying. So all of these things that have been done instead of buybacks over the last 5 years do look like there's certainly a reasonable argument to be made that they've been a spectacular waste of money and based on really uncertain science.
Just finally, Labor has also said it will alter the definition of how the 450 gigalitres, under what circumstances that extra water is delivered to South Australia. The Murray-Darling Basin Plan is so complex, but this 450 gigalitres is extra water promised to South Australia, which Barnaby Joyce, as Water Minister, admitted would never be delivered because he said it couldn't be delivered without significant social and economic detriment.
That's right. He wrote a letter to the then Water Minister in South Australia basically saying you're not getting it.
Now, is that legally the correct position to take?
Well, it wasn't at the time. It was, his letter was based on his own misunderstanding of the Basin Plan, because the Basin Plan didn't have the criteria that he was assuming were in it. You could make a case where if one of these efficiency measures cost one job, then it wouldn't go ahead. New South Wales and Victoria have got no interest in making sure South Australia gets that extra 450 gigalitres of water. My personal view is the whole thing should be scrapped and the 450 should just be added to the 2750 to make a figure of 3,200 and not stuff around with dubious science in relation to efficiency measures and supply measures.
So raise the whole target of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan.
Well, the whole thing should be done again according to science, which is what is meant to happen. And I don't care if they do that and then they say the figure's too high, as long as there's some honesty. I think what's annoying about the Basin Plan is that politics is dressed up as the best science. There is science in it too, but there's a lot of politics and it's meant to only be the best available science.
That's Richard Beasley SC, Council assisting the Royal Commission into the Murray-Darling Basin. Well, to housing, and investors are on notice. The federal opposition has now announced the proposed start date for its changes to negative gearing, and it's earlier than many expected. Labor says the changes will make it easier for first home buyers to get a foot in the door, but property groups are warning Labor's not allowing enough time for the industry to adjust. Political reporter Alexandra Beach has more.
There's been much speculation about when a Labor government would introduce changes to negative gearing. Today, the Shadow Treasurer, Chris Bowen, has declared the date, the 1st of January next year.
We're laying out this plan in plenty of time.
Labor's plan to overhaul the way investors use negative gearing has been a point of contention since the last federal election, and it will be one of the major points of difference between the two parties at the next federal poll. Labor argues the current concessions are too generous, so it wants to stop new investors from deducting rental losses from their income tax bill. The coalition warns that could see property prices in major cities fall even further and lead to rental prices rising. Here's Assistant Minister Zed Seselja.
We do support measures that improve affordability, but these measures don't. You don't help affordability by facilitating a housing crash. You simply don't.
But Chris Bowen insists the impact will be modest and says voters are receptive.
I find when we point out that the investments that are already made are grandfathered, indeed that the investments that are made between now and 1 January 2020 are grandfathered and not affected, people find that reassuring. Yeah.
He argues the start date is sensible and that by making the change over the Christmas holidays, in a quiet time for the property market, the transition will be smooth. But today's announcement has already attracted criticism from the housing sector. Graham Wolfe is the Managing Director of the Housing Industry Association.
It simply brings bad policy forward at a time when the residential building industry and the economy more broadly is looking for positive news from our political leaders. It's going to have an impact on the housing industry, on the economy, but equally importantly on jobs in the industry and on rental costs for those hundreds of thousands of hard-working households that are saving for a deposit.
Bruce Quigley is a senior advisor at the Tax Institute. He doesn't want to weigh into the debate over the merits of this policy, but he's worried the January start date seems very soon.
Well, I think it's extremely tight. Like all of these policy measures, the devil's in the detail. Well, I think a reasonable and probably the most common would be to have a start date of 1 July. I mean, that way also you avoid complications that could come with having a mid-financial year commencement.
Even if Labor does win government in May, this policy could be a tricky one to get through the Senate, depending on the makeup of the upper house after the election. And housing industry groups are warning they'll be lobbying crossbenchers to try to prevent it ever passing.
Alexandra Beach reporting. This is The World Today. Well, put quality over quantity is increasingly the message from the recycling industry in Australia as it grapples with China and now also India refusing to take our country's waste. Sustainability experts are urging Australians to only put pure plastic or paper materials in recycling and leave the rest for landfill. The drastic message comes as China and India have significantly reduced the amount of recyclable waste they take, leaving the recycling industry scrambling for new alternatives. Sarah White reports.
In a street in Sydney's inner city, bins are lining the street. One has a red lid on it, which means it's for general waste. But I'm looking inside right now and I can see all sorts of waste. There's plastic bottles, there's wine bottles, there's paper, styrofoam. Next to this red bin is a blue bin, and that says paper and cardboard. But it's overflowing. I can see there's rubbish that's actually fallen onto the ground, and that is not paper or cardboard. But the big problem at the moment, it doesn't seem to matter what bin you put your rubbish in, because if it's not going to get recycled, will it just end up in landfill?
Look, I think part of the reality is that with a shock to the system like we're seeing, there's always going to be some short-term pain, and that will include some products ending up in landfill.
That's Jenny Downs, who's a senior researcher at the University of Technology for Sustainable Futures. This shock to the system was when China drastically cut the amount of recyclable waste it would receive from Australia last year. Now the industry is feeling even more pain after India has just announced it's also banning plastic waste imports. Jenny Downs says Australians have always been good at recycling,
but that what we recycle will have to change.
So a really basic message is if you're not sure if something is recyclable, don't put it in just in case. So if there's, you know, paper and plastic in it, if it's metal and plastic, don't put it in the recycling bin. Try to stick to products that are quite pure in material. So, you know, our plastic water bottles, our laundry bottles, they're all just made of plastic. They're fine.
One high profile Australian is putting his mind to work out ways Australia can better recycle. Mining magnate Andrew Forrest recently suggested a tax on polymers in plastic and that people should be paid for handing in plastic for recycling.
We've been sending it to China. We're now sending it to Thailand, to Vietnam, to Indonesia. Exactly those countries who already cannot store their own plastic. I really think we've got about 5 years before we permanently poison our ocean.
This type of input is encouraging those in the waste management sector. Gail Sloan is the Chief Executive of the Waste Management and Resource Recovery Association of Australia.
You know, we've seen the initial wake-up call of China, and we did see a number of states invest and assist in industry. Probably Victoria was a standout with $35 million. We saw South Australia with $12 million, and that was immediate funding relief. But, you know, essentially since then, every government just kept hitting the snooze button, hoping it goes away and looking for overseas markets, when what they actually need to do is start acting. We need tangible action on the ground that's creating remanufacturing.
Vietnam and Malaysia have now said they'll restrict plastic imports by 2021, and Gail Sloan says it's only a matter of time when more countries follow suit.
What most countries are actually doing themselves is moving towards a circular economy. So they're saying that as, you know, as their own country, they're consuming enough material to recycle. So they're going to create their jobs in their nations. We need to do the same.
Gail Sloan, the Chief Executive of the Waste Management and Resource Recovery Association of Australia, and Sarah White reporting there. Well, evidence that climate change is posing a greater risk to the broader economy is putting company directors at greater risk of being taken to court, according to updated legal advice out today. Barrister Noel Hutley SC says it's now obvious that climate change is affecting the economy, and companies could face legal action for not acting on the exposure to investors. The updated warning comes as the World Meteorological Organization released its State of Climate report, saying 2018 was the fourth warmest year on record. Here's the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Warnings about climate change exposure are no longer limited to activists or environmental doomsayers. Updated legal advice for the Centre for Policy Development by barristers Noel Hutley SC and Sebastian Hartford Davis should be sending a chill wind through corporate boardrooms about the consequences of paying lip service to climate change.
What Mr. Hutley and Mr. Hartford Davis say in the opinion is that their findings in 2016 apply with even more force today. They say the benchmark is rising for directors on climate risks.
Travis McLeod is the Centre for Policy Development's chief executive. He commissioned the advice to build on growing warnings from regulators, most recently the Reserve Bank, that company directors could end up in court or face heavy fines if they ignore risks to the broader economy and investors who are demanding greater disclosure.
They do say that exposure for company directors is rising probably exponentially with time, and they say those developments constitute a profound and accelerating shift in the way that Australian regulators, firms and the public perceive climate risk and elevate the standard of care that will be required of a reasonable director.
And those significant warnings have come from the Reserve Bank and the prudential regulator APRA. So surely the risks about a changing climate must now be resonating in corporate boardrooms around Australia.
You would hope so, Peter. I mean, since 2016, APRA, ASIC and Deputy Governor Guy Debelle earlier this month have all warned that climate change risks pose significant and escalating risks to the financial system and to Australia's economy. I think what we can say now is that this provides very little wriggle room for directors who wish to ignore the impacts of climate change.
The advice also says regulators now expect much more from companies rather than just a cursory acknowledgement and disclosure of risks, and more importantly, that a court might now see the risk as foreseeable.
What they say in this new opinion, and it's probably best to quote from it, the effect of regulatory and investor intervention is that large-scale firms will be expected to invest seriously to monitor, manage and respond to climate change risks. As time passes, it is increasingly obvious that climate change is and will inevitably affect the economy, and it is increasingly difficult, in our view, for directors of companies of scale to pretend that climate change will not intersect with the interest of their firms.
The updated advice comes as the World Meteorological Organization releases its State of the Climate report, which says 2018 was the fourth warmest year on record.
It's almost like the two-speed economy. You know, there's a broad perception that there is some doubt about climate change, some reticence on behalf of, say, the Australian public to take action. But the reality is quite different.
Professor Mark Howden, Vice-Chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, says without action, Australia's economy remains exposed.
So the question really is about how do we start to think positively about climate change, using our smarts that we have in Australia, creating new opportunities, but at the same time not sort of kidding ourselves, but this is not a good story for Australia.
Travis McLeod says the warning isn't just for big investors, but for anyone with a superannuation fund.
Exactly. The findings in this updated opinion are relevant not just for company directors, but for fiduciaries and everybody in Australia who's interested in where their life savings are being invested.
Centre for Policy Development Chief Executive Travis McLeod with the ABC's Senior Business Correspondent Peter Ryan. Facebook is set to ban the praise, support and representation of white nationalism and white separatism. The social network, which also owns Instagram, has come under pressure after the Christchurch attacks were live streamed on its platform. But will the move curb the use of social media to spread hatred and encourage violence? I spoke to Tom Sulston, a director of Digital Rights Watch.
What we are seeing from Facebook here is that they are kind of raising the bar or lowering the bar for that behaviour to be considered unacceptable. We've known for a long time that white supremacists use dog whistling and metaphors and subtle messages to engage their supporters, and this recognises that and acknowledges that it's not acceptable.
Facebook has only come to this over the last 3 months. They say they've had conversations with academics who are experts in race relations, and it's confirmed that white nationalism and white separatism cannot be meaningfully separated from white supremacy. Is that naive to only realise that in the last 3 months?
I think it would be somewhere between naive and cynical to not want to do anything about hate speech being spread on their platform. Facebook is still a commercial entity. It's still driven by clicks and interactions and use and its ability to advertise and target advertisements. Whether it is some kind of blissfully naive behaviour where they just didn't realise that white supremacists were that awful, or whether it was cynically hanging on to those individuals for as long as they could to get as much traffic through their platform as possible, I wouldn't be able to say.
We know that since the Christchurch massacre, there's been calls for the tech companies to act. Is any company other than Facebook taking steps already?
All of the social media platforms that exist do have policies on the use of their platform and what they consider to be acceptable use of the platform and the speech that they are willing to tolerate. And the amount of moderation that they do varies between platform and platform, and where they draw the line of acceptable and unacceptable speech varies as well. They do tend to struggle with what is genuine hate speech and what are, for instance, people talking about hate speech. All of the social media platforms have to grapple with this issue. I don't think any of them we could say have got it right just yet.
Is the risk of further policing these platforms that we drive people with these views underground, is it better to have them where we can see them?
No. The use of social media by hate groups is not necessarily to organise. There are, you know, other systems that are not Facebook that these people use to organise themselves. What social media is used for is to spread their message of hate and to generate propaganda. And so it is about the publishing and the public dissemination rather than the organising.
And do you think the new measures that Facebook has announced go far enough, confirming that white nationalism and white separatism are now on their blacklist, if you like, for posts? Is there more they could be doing?
I think the devil will be in the detail. There are certainly issues of the way Facebook moderates content that are not very good about them, the way they do that, and especially the working conditions for a large number of their moderators who have to view all of this content and make decisions about whether it's acceptable or not. What we find is that the rules are applied inconsistently, even within one social network. So there definitely will be more challenges for social media companies in the future.
Tom Sulston, a director with Digital Rights Watch. And that's all from the World Today team for this week. The program's supervising producer is Michael Edwards, associate producer Barney Porter, technical production by Kem White and Mariam Zahr. We'll be back same time Monday. I'm Sarah Dingle. Have a great weekend.
A three-year Al Jazeera investigation has turned Australian politics on its head.
I have never sought donations from the NRA.
While Al Jazeera was secretly investigating One Nation, they may have bumped into a Russian secret agent.
Sex, guns and lies.
Russia, if you're listening, is looking at the Russian who infiltrated the NRA. Could she be the key to finding out what really happened in the 2016 US election? It's on the ABC Listen app now and wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.